copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
This is quite a daunting task for me, humbling task. I'm not a theologian, so I'm not theologically trained, and I'm not here to try and tell you or teach you about any theology, but what I do hope to do is to set you thinking about some of the theological challenges that you face in terms of taking the truths of Scripture and translating them into the hearts and lives of our flocks, the sheep that we seek to serve with the truth. Because we are immersed in one of the most powerful and influential social and cultural revolutions of recent times, as I speak, the sexual revolution. And the reality we have to face is that this revolution is bringing a unique set of challenges to Christians. Fundamentally, the question is this: are traditional Christian sexual ethics any longer plausible in today's world? Could it be that our beliefs are not only no longer plausible, but that they actually cause harm? And if either of these possibilities is true, then what does this mean for our understanding of the authority of Scripture? And as I hope you are well aware, Christians, including evangelical Christians, are beginning to divide on these issues. And we need dearly, we would all wish it would all go away and allow us to get on with what we'd love to do. But it is not going away. It is very much coming at us. And I'd really like to suggest we need to wake up and ask, how does the truth that we believe relate to the realities out there that are coming down the train track at us? Indeed, the realities we're immersed in as I speak. So before we go looking for the answers to some of those questions, and we're going to be skating over stuff this morning, it's a huge topic, and inevitably we're just going to be touching on some of the issues. Before we go looking for the answers, what I want to suggest is perhaps we need to understand the questions a little better. And the question is that I have is when I look at the speed and the scale of this social and cultural revolution of the past 5 decades, I find myself saying, what is the secret of its power, its cultural power? And to begin to explore that question together, I want to tell you a story. And the story begins with a little boy, and he's aged about 9, and he's living in the mid-1950s. And he asks his grandmother, Granny, he says, and he's from a Christian home, and she's a Christian granny, and he's in a Christian family, and he's in a church. And he says, Granny, what does the word pregnant mean? Now, he knows, actually, but he thought he'd try it out on her. And as you'd guess, I'm the little boy, actually. This is from my own story. And do you know what she said to him? She said, I don't know. I don't know. And that little vignette is an insight into the culture of shame and fear and ignorance and avoidance of this whole area of sexuality that shrouds our Christian culture. We find it hard to talk about sex. And I think some of us need this morning to face up to the fact that you'd rather not be talking about it this morning, and you'd rather be getting back to something you see as more kind of mainstream theologically. And we'd rather avoid this. And that vignette's just a small introduction into that little boy's walk into his experience of being made sexual in the image of God. And his body explodes at age 13 with eros and desire and an aching. He does that and he walks into that experience in ignorance and fear. And his mother has a little chat with him on the way back from the bus stop, and he comes out of that conversation understanding that there's something dirty that men and women do together that mustn't involve him. And his father leaves him a book in his bedroom when he's 15, which tells him one or two things he most definitely must not do. And this little boy, well, it happens to be me, but actually it also happens to be your grandchildren and your children, and many of you here, it's your experience. And of course, some of us have had a much, much, much better experience than that. But how many of us can honestly say that it was our Christian home, or our church was the place where we learned about how our erotic longings can be good under God? And the Catholic theologian Christopher West says, if teaching and talking about these issues in our church culture, teaching about sex were a food, most of us have been brought up on the starvation diet, he says. Epitomized by this kind of Roman Catholic theologian suggested abstinence from sex on Thursdays in memory of Christ's arrest, on Friday in memory of his death, on Saturday in honor of the Virgin Mary, on Sunday in honor of the resurrection, and on Monday in commemoration of the departed. If one of you has a headache on Tuesday, that doesn't leave very much space. And that kind of captures the culture that invades and pervades Protestantism too. And of course things are better today, but I'll tell you, the young men and women that I talk to, things are often not that much better. The starvation diet. Well, whilst this little chap here, let's leave him or her standing there for a moment, and we're going to cross the Atlantic. And over in the Atlantic, there's a grown-up boy there. I think he's probably in his late 20s. And he is about to launch the world's first ever mass-market girly magazine. And it is called Playboy. And the man is Hugh Hefner. And we're talking mid-50s. And looking back over those days recently, in an interview before he died, Hefner said one of the motivations for launching that magazine was a reaction to the, quote, hurt and hypocrisy of my religious upbringing. And in a way, Hefner's saying, we've had enough of the starvation diet from now on. It's going to be fast food. And you see, the reality we have to face, friends, if the human spirit is presented with a choice, if this little chap is presented with a choice between starvation and a Big Mac, what is he going to choose? And so it was activists like this, with their freedom, their liberation narrative from that culture, who launched and drove forward this revolution, which is founded on a story of freedom for the human spirit. You know, the political theorist Joseph Nye, he talks about hard power and soft power, and these activists wielded and continue to wield hard power, but I think that often distracts Christians from what I think is perhaps the real source of its power. Soft power, as Nye called soft power, the ability to get what you want using attraction. And it's the soft power, with its appeal to the human spirit, with its simple story of freedom for you, which animates and draws out our interest and our desire. And so, power of story I think, is the secret of its power. And this was a story about freedom. And indeed, it was a freedom grounded in one of the most, or rather a freedom that spoke into one of the most profound questions we ever ask as human beings, which is, who am I? Who am I? And where do I go looking for the answer to that question? And this story of freedom said you need to look inside yourself for the answer to that question. You search for a truth within. You look deep, and then you live authentically with the truth about yourself that you find there, and you express that truth authentically. Robert Bella, the sociologist, called this expressive individualism. Expressive individualism is the 1950s, and interesting how he arrived at that term. He said the whole notion of individualism, a term coined by Alexis de Tocqueville, he said was grounded in the American dream of self-reliance. How do you make something of the world? How do you survive here? You rely on yourself. And he said that this is a kind of utilitarian individualism, in which you rely on yourself to make something of the world and your family and your life, you see? Utilitarian individualism. But then with the rise of psychology in the 20th century and therapy culture, utilitarian individualism gave way to expressive individualism. Here, you rely on yourself not to make something of the world, but to make something of yourself, self-fulfillment. And so the cultivation and expression of your true inner self, your authentic self, becomes the main line of your life's journey. Expressive individualism. And we can feel the power of this new narrative all around us. Look inside yourself. It's everywhere around us, and you can see its toxic seduction, or intoxicating seduction rather. It offers a picture of the unencumbered self, a self set free from authorities and dogma and tradition and religion and hypocrites like you, with your straitjacketing little sets of rules that shoehorn people in and that exclude to the margins and push outside your barricaded church doors the people who don't fit. Well, you see, this is a vision of the authentic self, which says you look within and you find the courage to just be yourself, the unencumbered self, a self set free. And indeed, this notion of individualism, it's freighted with virtue, almost in the Aristotelian sense, a promising flourishing. When we live authentically, we flourish, as well as finding freedom within. And we discover fairness, because it creates a culture in which I say, you allow me to be my true self, I'll allow you to be your true self. Fairness. No one gets excluded, we're all included. And it's hard to resist. I mean, anybody against freedom here? Put your hand up. And you take this intoxicating offer, prospect, promise of freedom, and then weave it together into a great story, a simple story, and nest that story in numerous small stories of courageous people who had the courage to break free in rom-coms and sitcoms and movies. And then you tell it over and over and over again, and you win a culture. And so, In stories like Will and Grace and Friends, they made us laugh. You know, and we feel empathy for these people, and so we become open to their ideas. And in films like Brokeback Mountain and The Magdalene Sisters and The Imitation Game, Alan Turing, if you're British, he may have saved your life, saved the war for us. So what did you do after the war when you caught him outside of your little sets of rules? You told him he goes on the drugs or he goes to jail. He took the drugs and he was dead in 2 years. Is that freedom? And so in films like that, they made us cry. And they drew us into the narrative and again opened us to the ideas, the power of story. And it's won your kids' hearts already, this narrative, because all of them are watching Frozen. And you know, in the song Frozen, let it go. There are no rules for me. Let it go. And Frozen captures us with a picture, not simply of accepting yourself, but this is enthroning yourself. Anybody against freedom here? Madonna, I am my own experiment. I am my own work of art. You can do it. The little people will help you up, will help you be free of the hypocrites. Have you seen the rates of sexual abuse in churches with their shame culture as they covered up and put under the carpet and closed it down because they couldn't even tell their little boys what pregnant meant? Well, we're broken free from that shame of the past. And what I often do when I tell this story, you know, we return to this little chap here, and he's in your churches, he's in your hearts, actually. And the problem is he's got a good idea what we're against. I mean, he knows there's a pornography seminar coming up, the once a year pornography seminar, which we do. He's got a good idea what we don't do, but what he's saying to us is, but what are we for? What's our story? Given the power of this story in which he is immersed. And sometimes I break and I say, how are we feeling right now? And one pastor put his hand up, he said, I'll tell you how I'm feeling. I'm feeling, I hope what's coming next is good. Because I'm depressed. Because if I'm honest, I don't thought this before, but what I'm feeling in my heart is that this story, it might be true. And I may be on the wrong side of history. And what I try to do in not just telling the story, but acting it out a little, is to just convey something of its power, that it not only makes us think it might be true, but it makes us feel we want it to be true. And how do we respond? How do we help this little chap besides our annual pornography seminar? We respond with facts, with lists, with information. When the bishops of the Church of England are eventually bounced into making some sort of statement about what Christian marriage is, it reads more like the terms and conditions of a software upgrade than a manifesto for human flourishing. They've got Frozen. We've got 6 pages of the Christian doctrine of marriage and silence and hoping it'll all go away. And will someone else do a seminar on the... Oh, let's get a psychiatrist to do it. We'll outsource it to them. And he's got a good idea of what we're against, but what are we as theologians, pastors, teachers, shepherds of our people, what are we telling them it's for? As Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, said, it's no use responding to a great story with facts. You've got to tell a different story. And it's back to him. So what is our story? And that's the challenge for you, for me. Now, look, I just want to stop because this is the story we're swimming in, we live in. It's in the air, it's in our culture. I just want you to notice three things about it. First of all, I want you to notice its simplicity. It's simple, isn't it? A simple story of freedom. It has all of the narrative structure of a good story. It starts with a context, then it presents you with a problem, it brings in a solution, and we all live happily ever after. And we have some great heroes to bring the solution to pass. Simple. Now, you all know it's far more complicated than that. If you're doing an analysis of the evolution and development of the sexual revolution, you would say, it didn't all start with Hugh Hefner. It's not as simple as that. It's far more complicated. So if you're an economist, you'd say, you haven't mentioned economics, how post-war prosperity liberated women from their financial dependence on men, and they were able to get out from under, as the story is told, patriarchy with its oppression. And if you're a public health physician here, you'd say, well, the economic analysis clearly is a factor, and this is multifactorial, but I'll give you three words that explain the sexual revolution as a public health physician. The first word is the second word is contraceptive pill. And at a stroke, we uncoupled sex from its consequences, and whoosh. We'd never tested the boundaries of our relationships of previous centuries, marriage, faithfulness. We never tested them with this degree of possibility, freedom. If you're a philosopher interested in the history of ideas, it didn't all start with Hugh Hefner. There have been recurrences of a search in the deep interior through human history. Maybe the last time was in the new romanticism of the 19th century with artists such as Rousseau and Delacroix with their search and talk of the and portrayal of the deep interior, the search within for the deep, deep interior. Or maybe it goes back to Gnosticism with its hatred of the body and its search for the inner light and its elevation of the spirit. So it's far more complicated than this story of freedom. But you see, that's my point. Friends, we could say we need a seminar on queer theory and the theological response to queer theory and the thoughts of Judith Butler and so on, Foucault. And we do need to engage at that intellectual level. We do need to engage at the level of truth. But the power of this story is that the vast majority of people out there, certainly in Western Europe, certainly in Western Europe, and amongst young people in Eastern Europe, more than you'd think, I reckon. But the power of this story is they don't know about Delacroix or Judith Butler, never heard of her. They don't know about queer theory, and they've never thought about the economic analysis. But they do know that you just need to be yourself. Their hearts have been won with the simple narrative of expressive individualism. And that is its power. That is the source of its cultural power, its simplicity. And then, if you think about it a little more, there's the power of its cultural embodiment. And I'm just going, if I might, just to pull up another slide, because I have... here we are. I have missed out one or two slides, strangely. Right, here it is. So we notice this story is its simplicity. It is simplistic in many ways. Second, I want you to notice it's a culturally embedded story. It's capable of embedding itself in culture. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that it's recruited cultural icons, artifacts into its story in a way that to tell its story for it. Let me give you an example. Supposing you're a Martian and you land on Earth and you meet me and you say, show me one or two things around here, and I take you for a walk and we pass a bank and he says, what's that bank for? It's a Lloyd's bank. I said, well, what we do, banks are for putting money in, and usually it's safe there and they will look after it for you and you can take your money out, and you open something called a bank account and you have to go in and ask them if you can open it, and normally they'll say yes, and you can open a bank account and put your money in there and they'll keep it safe. They may even lend you some money if you ask them nicely. So he says, well, that's interesting, because what then does this picture here mean? And these pictures are in banks, Lloyd's Bank, all around England. All right? He says, now what does this mean then? Obviously, it's a time of great rejoicing when he says, yes, you can have a bank account. You know? I mean, look at this guy. Look at his eyes. He is ecstatic. There's a sense of this is a plane that's landed safely, that's come home. And you can see, having a bank account in your culture must be incredibly relieving and life-giving and thrilling. And you'd have to say, no, that's not what this is about. And he'd say, well, it doesn't say what it's about. There's no words on it, not a single word. And so what you'd have to say to him is, you'd say this, well, look, it's a long story. But you see, we used to think, and then you tell him how the sexual revolution recruited marriage as on the basis of inclusivity, that if marriage, the goods of marriage are good for heterosexual, if it's great for heterosexuals, if it binds men to their responsibilities in faithfulness, why ever would you want to withhold it from homosexuals, for goodness sake? We include them as well. And so you tell him the story, and you say, so this bank is basically on the side of the story which says pretty much all right-thinking people today believe this. And that's why it doesn't need to tell you what it means. It assumes that all right-thinking people are on board. Now, the sociologist Peter Berger coined that term plausibility structures. And this is a plausibility structure. It is the social and cultural conditions which lend plausibility to those beliefs. And once an idea has recruited plausibility structures culturally, it has become a powerful idea, because all right-thinking people believe this. The role models, the cultural icons, the thought leaders tend to believe this. And so the little people out there, most of our thinking is pattern matching. We kind of go with, we're socially very sensitive in our thinking to what others believe, and we fall in with the cultural story. So this story is not only simple, it has become culturally embedded, it's also become subconsciously embedded. And what I mean by this is that it is so prevalent that it's changing our default moral intuitions. What do I mean by that? If I say to you, let me give you a little story. A brother and sister, they've always been close. He's 23, she's 21, 20. They've always been close. Mum and dad divorced a few years ago. They've looked out for one another. And he's just graduated from Oxford with a first class degree, and they go to celebrate to Tuscany for the weekend. They have a lovely dinner. And at the end of dinner, he says, look, hey, we get on our house on fire. I know you're on the pill. I've got a condom with me. Why don't we make this real and have sex just tonight? Is that right or wrong? You don't have to think about it. Your guts tell you that's wrong. It's incest. Most people out there don't have to think about it. They've never thought about incest. They've never thought about the ethical basis for their instinct that incest is wrong. They just know it in their gut. You see. And most of our moral intuitions are initially gut level. They're shaped over time by reason, by argument, by culture. But then they sink down to become knee-jerk responses. And in the past, most people had a knee-jerk response to homosexuality, for example, that was disgust. You say, oh, anal sex, no thank you. Disgust, don't want to think about it anymore. And what the revolution has done with these stories, as they draw out our empathy for the characters, is at this under-the-bonnet subconscious level, it's led us to begin to replace those feelings of disgust with feelings of compassion. Compassion. And so you can have a Christian granny in your church whose grandson comes out gay. And she's always had clear views about homosexuality, say. And now it's her grandson. She loves this boy. And she's heard about how he's been bullied at school. And she can flip to becoming LGBT affirming. And she flips not on the basis of rational thought, but on the basis of a substitution of one feeling response, compassion, for another. And the LGBT community, with its stories, with its narratives, will help her do that. And so change for many Christians can be a thought-free zone as they shift their emotional responses. And I think Tim Keller's right when he says that if you can flip so quickly from one to the other, maybe your previous position about LGBT issues was bigotry, because it wasn't founded on any rational thought, any rounded biblical basis that was also compassionate and grace-filled as well as truth-based. It was just bigotry. It was disgust. And that's why you're so susceptible to the emotional power of the revolution, because in these stories of courageous little people who were bullied and driven to the margins, who stand up and say, this is who I am, get over it. In that power, that they're so susceptible to shifting. So I just want to remind you, this is the story we live in. And this is the story to which we must begin to scratch our heads as theologians, as pastors, with the big question, well, what's ours? And how do we even begin to respond to this revolution? Should we stop for a minute? Could I just ask you, you probably hate doing this, but just to turn into little groups of two or three. The question is, did anything ring true in what I was just saying, in your experience? We're zooming along here, but help me out, folks. I'm aware that we're operating in different contexts. So some Eastern European cultures, very different to Western European. Although I would say, again, when I've traveled around Eastern European, I've been impressed with how many younger people, their hearts are already well involved in this kind of narrative. So, but I'd love to hear. So what rung true, do you think, in what we were just saying? Or maybe what didn't ring so true in your setting? Let's pool some of our experience on this, please.
On the culture, we agree very much with your analysis. We recognize it in our own lives, in the lives of kids and grandkids. Grandkids in this case.
Grandpa.
They're watching the series, and this is indeed the story that's going on. I was just wondering, in fact, in many of our sermons, we happily draw on culture as the source for the stories.
And yes.
I was wondering if by doing that, we are not indirectly affirming their authority or their function in giving us story. Even though we are selective in the stories we pick from films as sermon illustrations, we tend perhaps indirectly affirm the movie industry as a legitimate source for stories to enlighten what we are preaching. And that may be slightly uncomfortable thinking about it. But
what do others think?
I have been hearing everything you've been saying through the lens of thinking I've got a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old.
Yeah.
How on earth am I going
to
deal with it? And I suppose it comes back to the larger question, therefore, of are we seeking to keep our children out of as much popular culture as we possibly can? And we have structures among evangelicals are doing that, homeschooling, etc., etc. Or are we trying to so thrill them with the better story that we're going to talk about that they can see the flaws and the gaps and have an aversion to it? I tend to think turning away from stories in general is the way forward to that.
Turning away from stories in general?
I think it's both. We helped start a Christian school in Jackson, Tennessee. You immediately get accused of escaping the world, not being salt and light, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter how much I try to shelter my children. The culture gets at them. I think it's both. I think it is having a family life where you're... We talk in the States about engaging the culture. And I get it, I get it, I get it. At the same time, I would beg Christian mom and dads to have your home be a culture. You are building a beautiful thing in that home. And your children get raised with a better story, and they are raised realizing that their culture in that home and that church is just as real a culture as the dominant culture.
Mm-hmm.
So scrap the paradigm that the dominant culture is the culture. It's another culture. And your home should be a beautiful culture. Your church should be a beautiful culture. I think it's both and. You're building something beautiful in the home. You're embodying a beautiful culture. There's nothing wrong with sheltering 6-year-olds from everything that's out there. And you portray the beauty of the new heavens, new earth, the kingdom of God. You want them to live a certain way because that's the best thing for them. That's the best thing for your neighbors. So, thus and so.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you. Other thoughts on that? Yeah, can I just follow? Doug, are you saying that we need to stop telling stories or giving visibility or space to the concept of stories?
No, stories in its as a category.
Right. Good. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, what do we use as the source for our stories?
Right.
And what do we say implicitly by sourcing our stories from particular areas or particular industries?
Okay. Okay. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
I would say that we cannot avoid stories.
Yeah.
We need to engage all stories, good stories and bad stories.
Yeah.
So if I use a good story, it doesn't mean that I give a validation to a bad story. But also I engage the bad story by debunking or bringing up a false narrative or something. So engage all stories.
Yeah. Yes, please.
One thought that came to my mind in terms of the story is. I think, in my understanding, there has never been a time before where pleasure has been so easily accessible, so cheaply or free. And one of the effects of that is boredom. And so the story I think we live in is more the story of the problem of pleasure. There's, of course, other things, so I'm not trying to make it simple. What's the English word? Simplistic. But I think one of the things that's coming up in my understanding and observation of children and families and life, at least in our parts of the world, is that it's the problem of pleasure. because it's so easy, it's free, and it's a quick fix for a short time, and then it deadens the soul, and it deadens the emotion, and then there's not enough any longer. Then you need to try something new, something different, and it's just a spiraling problem. So I think the problem thing,
okay,
in a sense, is, I may be wrong, but in a sense is almost overtaken by the problem of pleasure of our time.
So this takes us back to different levels of analysis, you know, how we try to construe what's going on around us. And what we didn't touch on was, you know, I was saying there's the economic analysis and so on. We didn't touch on the theological analysis, and maybe some would want to use the lens of idolatry, that we take the good gifts of God and we pervert them to a wrong end. And certainly good gifts of God are pleasure, but we take those pleasurable gifts of God and we make them objects of worship, and so we could look at it through an idolatry lens potentially.
Well, I was thinking, even if I may just,
you know, please, yeah, yeah.
I was thinking even in the sense of shortening the time between the moment of conception and then the moment of the pleasure of biting an apple. You know, there's a process, a natural process from the moment that the tree buds and the moment that you pick up an apple, and that time has been so reduced.
Yes.
The moment I can desire something, want something, and the moment I can actually have it.
Yeah.
And it's a virtual nothing.
So everything is fast food, and so if it isn't fast food, we move on to find instant gratification. Yeah. And of course, technology feeds.
Yes.
Gosh, this will take us into a whole other area, but it's a great point. Thank you. Can we leave that one hanging? The pleasure as an analysis of what's going on, or the pursuit of pleasure, instant pleasure, dopamine. Any other points, please? Don't want anyone to feel short. Yes, please.
I'm not sure if I will be able to express myself in the right way, but what I was thinking, I was a little concerned by the way you presented the challenge or the tension. Yes, it is wrong for the grandma to say what she said, and she was lying, and she was unwilling to take out the challenge, in a sense. But I feel that in presenting the guy who started the Playboy as him reacting to the wrong of the Christians, rather than following his sinful desires and lusts that are pervasive in society,
yeah,
I think it's a little bit too much blaming on the Christians.
Yeah,
yes, we are fallen people and we do make mistakes.
Yeah.
This
oh, goodness me.
Feeding on the sin of humanity.
Yeah, you don't think I believe this story. What I'm saying is, that's the great story that's out there. You know, whether that was his motivation or not, I have no idea. And I'm sure it was, if it was a part of it, there were layers of other stuff in there as well. No, absolutely with you. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying this is what I think is, you know, a fair and comprehensive evaluation of history. That's why I said it's far more complicated than that. But it is actually, it's a story, and it makes a great story that we pin it on you, and this is all a great escape, a jailbreak from people like you.
It's very true to me that we need to do a good job in presenting the true story.
Yeah.
It will be a little more challenging story than the simple story of just following. Heart.
Exactly, yeah.
Because we don't want to be who we are, we want to be who God wants us to be.
Yeah.
And that will, you know, involve...
And it takes more words.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say this narrative of freedom is snake oil. It's junk. It's misleading people. It's drawing them into not only what we would see as a kind of idolatry of self, but the social science stacks up in favor that this is leading us nowhere. It's not producing any of the promises that it's made. Flourishing? Where's that? Fairness? I mean, flourishing, we haven't got time to look at these data. People are having less sex now. Not more. This was supposed to fast food. It would offer, you take the breaks off and people achieve their full potential sexually and flourish sexually. Well, if you look at the best UK data, 1990, 2000 and 2010, the rates, the average rates of people having sex, intimate sex, is falling. In fact, it, at the moment, as Professor Spiegelhalter, who's a Cambridge academic, says, and he's in the news because he is a very good academic, he's written a book, Sex by Numbers, he plots the data, and he says, if you extrapolate this graph, no one will be having any sex at all by the year 2040. Now, as a very good statistician, he says and knows you never extrapolate graphs. And also he says, I doubt very much that that'll be the case. But it is interesting that a revolution that promises more delivers less, which is the character of idols, isn't it? They promise more and more, but deliver less and less, till they have everything, you have nothing. And it's a rather interesting take, I think, that this revolution's the goods that it promised and actually what it delivers on idolatry. So, you know, that's a great point you make there. Look, let's think of, because time's moving on, how we orientate ourselves to this story. And I think picking up Dirk's point, I don't want to misunderstand or misconstrue it. It may be heard as saying we kind of reject those stories. We don't use them at all or tell them. I just want to just ask, is there a danger in doing that? That we give the impression that we don't get the valid questions that those stories are attempting to answer? Because I think we make that mistake over and over again. We pile in with the answer before we've signaled that we get the question. So the question is, homophobia, and I don't use that term myself, but as it's used out there to draw together the existence of prejudice and hatred of people who are LGBT, it's a reality, folks. We've got to understand that it is a reality, and you'll see it's a reality when it occurs in your family, when a member of your family identifies with as LGBT. It can be very hard. Not always. It can be overblown as a phenomenon, but it is a reality. I'll give you an example. There's a same-sex attracted young Christian called Luke Aylin, and since his earliest days, you know, if your experience was in the playground, you're drawn to the little girls. He didn't choose to be drawn to little boys. It was just his. He said, "Choose out. Will I choose this burden for me as a Christian?" He wants to live faithfully with the Scriptures, so he is celibate. Okay, so he lives chastely, faithfully with the Scripture. But he shares, this is my experience, as does one of my pastors. Now, Luke Aylin wrote what I thought was a perfectly reasonable article in Christian Today on the film Beauty and the Beast. And he said, a lot of Christians won't watch this because it's got a gay character, you see. He says, are you sure we're being consistent? Because I know a lot of Christians who go home and they watch all kinds of stuff on television, sex in movies, but because this one's got a gay character, you're not going to watch it. Are you sure that's we're being consistent here? Or are we playing into a narrative that we elevate some sins over others? And we're hot on the LGBTs out there and we go easy on the divorce in here. So he says, let's be consistent here. Friends, read the comments section at the end. Read the comments from some apparently brothers and sisters who wrote in to Luke. And, you know, I'd not met him, but I found myself emailing him, Luke. I met him recently. Just say, look, Luke, we haven't met. I just want to say I'm sorry for what they said. I don't feel that kind of, those things they said to you in my heart at all. But I'm a Christian. If they say they're Christians, I want to say I'm sorry for that. Because we've got to understand, we've got to get the question. We've got to signal that. So if we say we're not going to respond to, you're not going to reference any of this, it can seem as if we're not. We make the same mistake, I think, over assisted suicide. Sometimes we want so quickly to get in with the answer, which is the sacredness of life, the sanctity of life. it might appear that we don't get the question of the real pain of someone choking on their food to death with motor neuron disease. And it's in response to that that people are saying about assisted suicide. Now, we do not agree. We disagree radically. But we have to signal that we get the question. Because otherwise, people will think, in this cultural drama, Christians are doing what you've always done. You just don't like gay people. You just don't like the people who don't fit. And you will drive them out. And we have to subvert that narrative by saying, no, we get the question here. And so I would always look for what the goods are in a narrative and try to link with them. And I think, and you may want to come back on this, but I think that Paul, his Mars Hill, Acts 17, is an example of that. In that, as you read it, what Paul does is he goes around looking at the idolatry. We read that quote that he was, quote, deeply disturbed. Deeply disturbed. His guts were wrenched by what he saw. He was upset. And you can feel him writing Romans 1 in his head. They exchanged the glory of the invisible God for creatures, and they stooped down before snakes and half human, half creatures. And his heart's broken that the human spirit, made in the glory and image of God, is prostrated like this before things. And he's deeply disturbed. And so then he gets his chance, and they put him up at the Areopagus. Now, here's his chance. What do we do? Do we let him have Romans 1? God has given you up, idolaters. It's very interesting. He says, as you know, people of Athens, I see that you're very religious. And then he tells them a story. As I walked around this morning looking at your gods, I saw this god and that god. And then I came across this, you see. It's quite interesting. He relates to their story by focusing on its question. It's spiritual. He links with their spiritual longings, the questions to which their idolatry is the wrong answer. So he says, I get the question. I have that question too. Who are we? Who is there? Well, here's my story that gives the answer to that, you see. And I do think there's an opportunity for us here. Because as we think about this story out there, you can deny it, you can batten down the hatches and become like the Amish and the Benedict option and hide away from it. And there is a sense in which we must defend our beliefs. Back to Peter Berger, cognitive minorities must defend their own plausibility structures. They must create plausible communities that show as well as tell their beliefs. So we've got to do that. But if our posture is just batten down the hatches, bolt the doors, is that, I don't know, is that gospel? Can't see it myself. Or you can fight the story and get the lawyers out, and we can defend our Christian values and religious freedom. And we do need to do that. Paul, you had no hesitation using his Roman citizenship to defend what's right. But if we make that the main line of our gospel engagement, then I think people out there could be forgiven for saying, you're just doing what you always did. You see, where were you when Alan Turing, you put him on the drugs? Who was defending his rights then? Not you. You put him on it. But now the pincers are closing on you. And now it's all religious freedom, and we've got to choose freedom. You're just motivated by your own selfish desire. That's, if we don't, we've got to be smart here about the way that we relate to this story. So if we're always fighting, it looks as if we're defensive. And I don't Or we can cave in to the story, get with the program. Or you can enter into its discourse and then tell your own. First of all, we connect with the questions, so we show that we get the questions. And the point of convergence between our story and theirs, as we walk along together, is, in my belief, identity. It's that big, fundamental human question of who we are. And we say, in terms of identity, this is our common human experience. We look up to the stars and we say, who are we? And that's my story too. And in fact, just like Paul tells his story on Mars Hill, he says, as I was walking around, actually, I think we need to make the story our own personal story. So you say, I want to know who I am as well. That's my. And I hear what our culture says. I hear what the movies say. Look inside yourself. Do you want to hear my story? I looked inside myself. I didn't find a truth there on which I'd build the foundations of my life, if I'm honest. And this is about authenticity, right? We've got to be authentic and real. If I'm honest, I found seeds of greatness, yes. And there's some things I'm really good at, but I found seeds of greed, and I found more than seeds of greed. I found greed, and I found hatred at times, and I found self-serving, and I found a shadow which has its roots in hell at times. And besides that, I found doubt and insecurity, and I wake up one morning and I feel one thing, and I wake up another. And you tell me to build the foundations of my identity on this shifting, insecure world of my inner life. And this is about being real. This is my reality. Can I share that with you? And for me, it wasn't so much in that dilemma of you're asking me to go from nowhere to somewhere. In fact, no, it's not. You're saying go from nowhere to anywhere. And I just don't think the human spirit can do that. It's not my story. Actually, there's lots of data. I could show you data that shows we've been trying for 5 decades to assert our own worth, autonomy, that the self declares its own law to itself. It's the great goal of idolatry, to be a law, to give oneself law. We've been trying to do that with worth for 5 decades, the self-esteem movement. You say how much you're worth. I'm special. I attract people to me. Now, I'm strong, you see. If you submit this to careful psychological evaluation in randomized trials, I'd love to show you the data, but the people who try to do this with low self-worth at the beginning of the trial, after rehearsing these statements, I'm strong, I'm worth it, you know, after rehearsing these at the end of the trial, 6 months later, they feel worse about themselves, not better. Why? Because it's just your own propaganda. That's all it is. And here's the thing. In my story, if I'm so bad at asserting my own worth, how much less at asserting my own meaning, my own identity? And so my heart looks out of myself. And when I did that, it isn't so much that in my story that I found God as he found me. It wasn't so much He entered my story as I was drawn into his. And there, in his story, he told me who I am. An image bearer. I bear the image of God, broken, disfigured, but being restored through Christ. And so in my story, you see this whole area. Identity isn't something discovered in the self or constructed by the self. It is a gift to the self. One of the great gifts of the notion of revelation is that God not only reveals who he is, the Word became flesh and dwelt, he reveals who we are. To those who receive him, he gave the authority to become children of the Most High, image bearers under restoration. And so who I am is I'm learning to be God's creature all over again. I'm learning to bear his image, to restore his image. And for me, freedom and flourishing come as I learn to live in harmony with my design. Friends, that has got to come from someone's belly. It's got to come from their belly. What we tend to do too often, we say, your identity isn't in your work, it's in Christ. And people say, yes, my identity's in Christ. It's just a string of words until they take this deep inside that I bear the image of God. And the quest of my life is to become all that he calls me into being as a bearer of his image. And you say, well, yeah, but what's this got to do with sex? That's the question. And in my story, what I find as I rustle the pages of the Bible is I find that the seeds of my greatness I spoke about, because I'm really good at some things, and I'm terrible at others, just as every one of you has, you feel your greatness at times. The foundation of that is I am like him, and he is a ruler, and therefore I'm a ruler. I'm mandated by him to rule the world and bring order and goods into this world. Friends, our sheep need to feel that in their belly so that in their day-to-day work they sense that they bear the image of God. But then as I rustle the pages of Scripture a bit more, I discover that God isn't only a ruler, he's a lover. He's a lover. And maybe the secret of who I am and how I order my loves, my erotic desires, maybe the secret to that is in looking at his love and who he is as a lover. Now, what kind of a lover is God? Well, we know he's a passionate lover. We know he's a faithful lover and he's a fruitful lover. And we don't have time to open up the Scriptures, but his passion for your maker is your husband, as a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. It's almost embarrassingly passionate. Later I passed by, and when I looked at you and saw that you were old enough for love, I spread the corner of my garment over you. Your breasts had formed. There's a passion here, and we could have a long chat about impassibility now. Or we could begin to say, how do we help our sheep understand that their passion, their desire is something to do with bearing the image of God and loving like he loves, a kind of love that leads to the desire to give of oneself to another intimately, wholly. But then as I look at the kind of lover he is, he's not only a passionate lover, he's a faithful lover. So when he speaks of that intimate, self-giving, uniting with his people love, it's always spoken of as a faithful commitment, isn't it? It's spoken of, in fact, as the central metaphor to describe his love emerges in the Old Testament as marriage. And so God's people, their idolatry is always seen as adultery. Because his love is a better for worse, for richer for poorer, till forever kind of covenantal love. And so that helps me see as an image bearer that when I love, and when I love passionately, intimately, self-giving, a union, a united love, it's always faithful. It must always be bounded by covenant, and therefore we enjoy the gift of marriage. And as that metaphor spills through and threads into the New Testament, John the Baptizer, one of the earliest titles of Jesus, is bridegroom, who comes for his people, for his bride. And then Paul, scratching his head about a couple having sex, this whole one flesh thing, he says, it's a great mystery, but I take it to refer to Christ and the church, for God, the implication is, has etched the central drama of the gospel into human flesh. A man and a woman giving sacrificially to one another show the very heart of God's self-giving, faithful, forever love. And it's fruitful love. God's love is in the creation passages. He's always calling for more, more, more. And so this intimate, self-giving love is ordered toward more in its nature. It is a fruitful love, the bearing of children, more image bearers. It's beautiful, productive love that echoes something of God. So in my story, I feel the same way as you. I feel this desire, but what I learn and what I believe with all my heart and what I believe the social science data is entirely supportive of is that when we live in harmony with this calling to love as He loves, we flourish and we discover fairness together and we find freedom in our spirit. Now, I know there are loads of questions. What about singleness? What about this? What about that? But I think that is the central inspiration of the story, that sex is for loving as God. We love one another as God loves us. It's a kind of experience of God's love. And I'm going to stop. If any of you want to read my book, I've kind of had a go at this in this book, A Better Story, surprisingly called.